You ever gone back recently to a trackpad that actually has a button, like a separate button area that you can't just click the whole thing? You ever?
Yeah, well, the one that we had of that, the non-unibody MacBook Pro, the button had been so filled with child filth that it would not click down, or would like get stuck down, like it physically would no longer. Yeah, so I guess that won't happen with the four stretch. I guess that'll just get at like an even crust of disgustingness. Kids are gross, man.
So we should do a little bit of follow-up. And one of you wants to talk about cellular service on Macs.
A couple of listeners gave us this. We talked a lot about the Mac last show, the viability of the Mac, whether it's going to be replaced by the iPad, if it's a dead platform, all that stuff. And multiple people asked us about a topic that has come up on the show before but didn't come up on the last episode. It's related to the question of, and I think Casey maybe was talking about this, how you can go anywhere with an iPad and do anything because it's got a cellular connection and it's got Wi-Fi and it's kind of all in one. And yeah, if you have a laptop, you can tether it, but then you also need your phone and then you're draining your phone's battery. And we didn't take the next step and talk about the topic, the evergreen topic of why do Macs not have cellular connections? What is it like? Because a lot of people think that would make the Mac a stronger competitor to even the Pro iPads, especially now that the Macs are very small. If you could have a MacBook One, second generation MacBook One with better battery life, a faster CPU, and a cellular connection, that would surely give an iPad Pro a run for its money as that single lightweight machine that you can take everywhere and work from anywhere with. Why is it the Macs, after all this time, don't have cellular? And I seem to recall the last time we talked about it, we had some vague ideas, but at this point, years later, I think, most of our vague ideas are like, well, they want to reserve that for the phone, and they think you should use your phone. But it's like, now what's the excuse?
So I think that the problem Apple has with putting a cellular modem in a MacBook or a MacBook Pro is twofold. One, it's more things to take up space and actually come to think of it, battery life. Things have to get ever thinner, or so we seem to think anyway. And two, why would you not have an iPhone with you? You have an iPhone. You have a way to tether it to your Mac. Why would you ever need an onboard connection on your Mac? Now, of course, this argument falls completely on its face when you point out, well, there's iPads with cellular connections. In fact, Casey, you have an iPad with a cellular connection. And I have an iPad with a cellular connection because I don't want to have to tether to my phone anytime I want to get online outside of the house, not when I'm not near Wi-Fi. So I don't know that I would buy a Mac that had a cellular connection, but it certainly is appealing. And it certainly would make me think twice about an iPad Pro if I was trying to like decide between an iPad Pro with cellular or, say, a MacBook One with cellular. I don't know, Marco, how do you think about it?
I would love a MacBook with cellular. I would absolutely love it. But as we discussed, you know, years ago when we first covered this topic, I think nothing has really changed in the way that the software environment on the Mac is designed. In most cases, most of the apps are designed, the system services are designed to assume they are on Wi-Fi all the time and to assume they can use large amounts of bandwidth. The system updater would, you know, that could download an update that's hundreds of megs. iTunes, they can background download new episodes of TV shows that you buy and stuff like that. And granted, a lot of these things are things that are maybe fading out of favor, but they still happen. You have all sorts of, you know, software updates happening all the time in the background automatically. And not just from Apple. It could be, you know, Adobe's updater and everything too. There's so much stuff in the Mac environment that assumes it can just assumes that if it has a connection, it can download large chunks of data in the hundreds of megs range. And there was a change in the APIs. I think with Mountain Lion, it was around Mountain Lion time when they moved to NSURL session, where they unified the API between iOS and Mac, and NSURL session has like kind of these global flags on sessions where you can say, you know, on any connection I run in this session, allow or don't allow cellular access. So if the connection is cellular, you could, you know, you as the app maker could kind of opt out of using it or opt into using it if you wanted to. So you could say, like, you know, if something is important, like if you open up a Twitter app and you're trying to fetch the timeline, use cellular data for that because that's probably what the user wants. But if you're checking a background update to see if there's any updates to your app, if you're Adobe, then maybe wait until Wi-Fi for that. So that system's been there for a few years, but the reality is I don't think any apps meaningfully are really using it. especially since there's no reason to for them to use it because there are no cellular Macs. So unfortunately, I just think the software environment is so wasteful of data by default that I think it would just result in way too much data usage. And I think, you know, Apple probably noticed that too. And also, you know, on iOS, you have the App Store and App Review to enforce that and to monitor that. And that's, App Review does monitor for excessive bandwidth usage. They have certain metrics, like you can't use more than X megabytes in X minutes unless the user's streaming media or something like that. You know, like there are certain limits that they at least used to monitor for. They probably still do. Anyway, all that is to say that, you know, on the Mac, you don't really have the software environment conducive to sipping data carefully when you're on cellular.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I agree with you, but have you used Trip Mode? Have you heard about this?
I haven't. Is that some kind of like little firewall thing, like little snitch or what?
Sort of, kind of. I think that it might have been Jason Snell that turned me onto this. I forget exactly who it was, but the tagline for this app is your mobile data savior. And it is not only for the Mac, it also works on Windows. And what it basically does is when it detects that you're tethered or on some other sort of low bandwidth connection, it will flip into a different mode where it will prevent every app from getting to the internet except the ones you whitelist. And it'll also keep track of how much data each of these apps is using. And so I have this installed on my laptop because on the rare occasions that I do tether, I, even though I have a crud load of data, way more than I would ever use in a month, I still want to be sure that I'm not doing something like, I don't know, downloading an episode of Mad Men. Right, Marco?
See, I don't buy any of these excuses because we're so much farther down the road. Like in the beginning, when, you know, cellular was just coming to iPads and Apple was first making iPhones, sure. But as Marco pointed out, they added this, the beginnings of these APIs a long time ago. It's a problem for Apple to solve for sure, but it can be solved. Like it's all it takes is some new software and, you know, like The trip mode thing is a great example of like they're not even the OS maker. Apple could implement something like that or a new set of APIs or make it opt in or like this is their problem to solve. Same thing with space in the case. Same thing with battery life. Like we have the technology. We can rebuild it. This is a thing that we could actually do. And you say, oh, but it's so hard. It's going to take a long time. Yeah, but it's been a long time. And so it's like, have you been working on this for 3 years? Or are you just like, well, it'll always be impossible and we should never even try it? Like, because it just, every time it comes up, we all say, you know, not that they all have to have cellular, right? But one model, pick one model to be like the bring this Mac everywhere with you and you will be able to get online everywhere. And we know most people aren't going to buy it because who wants to pay for, just like people, most people don't buy cellular iPads because who wants to pay for another cell connection or whatever, added, you know, right? But, you know, surely it has enough utility that if they were paying more attention to the Mac line, they would say, we can sell this. This is a value add feature. People will pay more for it. It will make the product more attractive. Would they sell more cellular Macs percentage wise than they do cellular iPads? Probably not. It would probably be less, and I bet the percentage of cellular iPads is super low anyway, but they keep making them because for the people who use them, they love them. Imagine if you said, you know what, iPads aren't going to have cellular anymore, just tethered to your phone. People would be pissed because they're used to that feature, and it took a lot to get, you know, the cell phone feature on iPads and an iOS working with all these different APIs. I don't know. I feel like after so many years, any excuse you had about how difficult it might be, it now changes into an excuse of like, I guess you just didn't decide it was important, because now enough time has passed that if you had decided it was important, we'd be 3 years into the transition period and we'd be well on our way to it being a thing. And when they did that new API, I thought, oh, this is the beginning, like a few more years and you know, they'll have this rolled out. But I guess they just don't think there's enough of a market for it to justify, you know, all the time and expense of changing the APIs and everything like that. I don't know. It just seems like another missed opportunity on the Mac, where if the Mac was selling much better and making them much more money or had more growth potential or some combination of those, this would be an obvious thing in the same way that larger iPads and a stylus were obvious in iPads, but Apple didn't pull the trigger on that for many, many years. And the iPad, Apple certainly thinks the iPad has more growth potential than the Mac, it seems. So anyway, I'm sad that there's still no cellular Macs. Although I don't expect any at the upcoming Apple event, which we'll talk about a little later.
Yeah, and real-time follow-up from the chat room, from the white box in the chat room. This person reminded me of the photos of the prototype MacBook Pro with an integrated 3G cellular modem. This is from Mac Rumors in 2011. And it's a really kind of weird-looking. It looks like a MacBook Pro, but it has like an extendable antenna on the side of the screen. We'll put a link in the show notes.
You know, I mean, I've been using tethering on laptops while traveling for 10 years now. Literally, like I was going through pictures earlier. I'm going to Tumblr tomorrow to kind of give a quick little talk about like the history. And I was going through pictures, and literally 10 years ago, I have a picture of me using a MacBook with a cellular modem plugged into the side of it, a little USB thing. And before that, I was using Bluetooth tethering with my old Motorola flip phone. And you know, tethering is awesome on laptops. Like if you have a laptop, you probably want this if you ever use it out and about. If you ever use it while traveling or if you work in coffee shops or whatever, you know, the dream of ubiquitous Wi-Fi never really came true. You know, everyone thought that, oh, cities would just be covered in Wi-Fi and everywhere you went there was Wi-Fi. And you know, it turns out maybe 20% of the places you go there's Wi-Fi, and it might suck and it might be insecure, which is a big problem these days. It might be slow, it might be metered. But the dream of this like free, ubiquitous, everywhere coverage and no security problems and always fast Wi-Fi just never came true. There's so many reasons to tether and to use your own cellular connections. And as time goes on, those reasons just increase as we get more and more mobile. Laptops keep getting smaller and even more compelling to bring with you if you're going somewhere and you want to get something done on a laptop. You know, especially like you look at the MacBook One or the upcoming Skylake MacBook Pros, which we'll talk about soon. These things keep getting smaller and better, and cellular connections keep getting faster. And you know, we do have data caps these days, but we also have now these pooled data plans where you can like add another device for $20 a month. Like back 10 years ago, I was paying $60 a month just for that cell modem, and now you can get them for $20 a month. Like just add it to your existing plan or whatever. So like, it seems like this would be the time to do that. If for some reason that time hasn't come yet, might as well do it now, right? But it just does seem like Apple doesn't care. And it seems like this is something they obviously did prototype it. They obviously decided not to do it. And, you know, John, I think you're right. Like, if they wanted to do this on the Mac, they could. The fact is, you know, the software environment isn't there for it now. But yeah, they've had 10 years to work on it, and they pretty much haven't. So that does make me sad, and I will keep tethering. It feels like such a weird hack to tether, because tethering doesn't actually work that well in practice. Like it, once you plug in, it's fine, but like if you're doing anything besides a USB connection, it is always a little bit flaky. Plus, not to mention, then it drains your phone battery. So there's like so many reasons not to tether or to tether over cable only, which is clunky. So it does make me sad that we probably won't see this from Macs, because I think if they can justify it for the iPad, might as well do it for Macs too.
Well, all those prototypes that they made, you know, the 2011 pictures or whatever, like what they learned from those first efforts is all the things we talked about, like, oh, it uses a lot of data, our environment is not set up for this, and drains our battery more and whatever. And all that does is let you know, what is it going to take to do this? And then they do the calculation. This is what it's going to take. This is the potential upside. And they just keep saying no. And, you know, and again, if the Mac sold more, if there was more of an upside, if they felt like there was more demand, like a million combinations, because you could say, oh, if there was more demand, they would do it. But also, if they sold 20 times as many Macs, because that would increase the number of sales, assuming the demand is proportional, right? Then that would, there's just so many factors that are working against them doing it. But the longer time goes on, the more it kind of stands out to me as a weirdness, because eventually you would hope the battery cost and the size cost or whatever of doing cellular would be, they're decreasing as a proportion of the overall available, you know. I guess you can't decrease transmit cost that much because you got to reach the tower and everything, but all the other associated stuff, how big is the chip you have to put in there, how much power does that chip take, how much room does it take, how much does it cost, like all those other factors. Time should be on your side, and eventually it should be like, maybe like when they added the FM radio to the iPod. You know what? What the hell? Throw it in there. But, you know, then there's a software part of it that they're obviously behind on. But, you know, the other thing that could help there is, like Marco was talking about, what if the cost of cellular connections and data continues to go down? And 5-10 years from now, unlimited data connections are standard and you don't pay a lot for them and it costs nothing to add. And it's just like, it just seems like it's got to happen eventually or the Mac could just go away entirely. But anyway, I miss it and I would buy one.
I totally don't buy any argument that it's a hardware limitation or that it would be too costly in the hardware, because the iPad is the biggest counterexample. If they can offer it in the iPad since 2010 for a $130 premium, then certainly they can offer it in the higher priced, larger and bigger batteried MacBook Pro line. Like, there's no reason why if it's in the iPad, you can totally do it in the MacBooks.
I mean, stands to reason. I don't know enough about the hardware, but it certainly stands to reason in my head that that's the case.
PC manufacturers also offer this. Like, this is not, it's not like no one's ever done this before. Like, you can buy a ThinkPad with a cell connection in it for like also about 10 years, I think. So like, it can be done. They just have chosen not to do it. And that I think is unfortunate, because I wish they offered that. And I think they could charge a good premium for it. Maybe $200. I'd easily pay $200 more. We'll see. I don't have high hopes for that, honestly.
Fair enough. Now, moving on. We got a really interesting reminder from Eitan Shulman, who wrote in to remind us that in February of 2015, it was discovered that the new Photos app contains something called UXKit. And we'll put a couple links in the show notes, one to Jason Snell's Six Colors and one to a friend of the show, Brent Simmons' blog. It appears that it's basically a reimplementation of UIKit, which is what's used to build apps on the iPhone, on top of AppKit, which is what's used to write apps on the Mac. And it's an interesting thing to think about. Well, you know, as these platforms, you know, kind of crawl ever closer to one another, do we think maybe this will be a new thing that maybe, for example, at WWDC this year, maybe Apple will release UXKit and make it easier for people like Marco, who don't really write Mac apps, to write an app on the Mac by using an API that's familiar to him?
I think we talked about this at the time.
I think so.
I think at that time, Brent's post had also come out. And it's like the consensus then, I still think it's the same now, which is, like, when we all saw Photos and these other apps that look so much like their iOS counterparts, it stands to reason. It's like, oh, a lot of people would say, oh, all they did was port the iOS applications to the Mac and sort of Macify them a little bit. And so many things in them were similar. And UXKit is kind of like, well, we know they had a Photos app on iOS. And we know this one visually and structurally is very similar to that. And so it stands to reason that if they wanted to make the development of the iPhoto replacement faster, they could say, is there some way that we can reuse, if not the code directly, then at the very least some of the structure of the application and some of the knowledge or whatever. Like, is there a way that we can take an iOS application and, you know, even if you're just using the sort of big box diagram of how the pieces fit together and what the class names are and everything like that, can we do that? Well, you could have this UXKit thing, which is kind of like a UIKit like wrapper on top of AppKit, so that the Mac looks a little bit more like iOS from the perspective of this code you're writing. But you would only do it if you were coming from that direction. And Brent Simmons' post is mostly skeptical about the idea that this would ever be a thing that they would throw out to developers. And it's hard to tell, because very often Apple does dog food its own APIs first in its own applications, then like a year later at WWDC, they're like, oh, here you go. And they don't mention like, oh, and by the way, we've been using this for a year or 2 years in our own applications to sort of work out the kinks. But they've done that with so many other technologies. But then again, there are other things that they use for their own applications that they never offer up, like the ProKit framework, which they use for Aperture back in the day, and I think Final Cut Pro, with like the weird, small, dark-colored widgets, and like those things were all... There was a ProKit framework that would, if you had those apps installed, would occasionally get updates.
We are very lucky they didn't offer that for anybody else to use.
Well, I mean, but I'm saying, like, it was...
The last thing the world needs is more ProKit apps.
They didn't just build one app on it. Like, oh, we had this weird code base and we did this thing. They built multiple apps on it, but it never graduated to the level, which I assume that was also, you know, either a wrapper on top of AppKit or its own weird thing. But it never came out into public. So I still think there is room, as Marco talked about last time, for Apple to introduce something that makes it easier for people with UIKit, either code or expertise or both, to make Mac apps. But I don't know if UXKit is it. Maybe UXKit is one attempt at what that might be like. And remember, the guys at Icon Factory did that Chameleon framework, which was another sort of thing where it's a re-implementation of the UIKit API on top of the Mac to help them, because they had UIKit applications that they wanted to bring to the Mac. All of those things are like, that they're kind of technical marvels that they work at all. But when you start to suggest the idea that this would be like the one recommended way to make Mac apps, like Apple would say, hey, you should use this to make Mac apps. Like, I don't think Apple wants to muddy the water. I think they want to have a clearer answer. And especially with Swift in the mix now, I'm not entirely sure that Apple is ready to come out with something that will help iOS developers write Mac apps better. Whether they think it's even, again, it's the same thing with like investment. Like, yeah, they could do it. They could do lots of different things here, but is it worth the investment? It would take a lot of developers and it would be difficult to do. And what would our payoff be? So obviously for their own internal applications, they decided it was worth it. And so they got UXKit and they'll probably use it. And if it's not already used in multiple places, it might be used in other places going forward as a way to make it cheaper for Apple to bring quote unquote new applications to the Mac, helping them take the, you know, expertise and maybe some of the code from iOS and bring it over to Mac apps. But I'm not sure they're ready to offer that to the public.
You know, as you were bringing up Chameleon, I was about to bring it up myself, and so I went and dug up the GitHub page for it. Last commit was May 16, 2014.
When it comes to this kind of, you know, major platform development framework, I mean, this is long-term stuff. These are things that last 10, 20 years. Apple's a very patient company when it comes to things like this. So, with lots of things, Apple's very patient, honestly. But in this kind of scenario, like, the transition to Swift, I think, is very, very important here. And also, we have to figure, like, where is Mac OS X going? You know, as we discussed last week, you know, if they are planning on some, like, major next-generation Mac operating system that's going to be a major departure from OS X as we know it today, they'll just wait till they do that. Like, they're not going to make a new OS X framework now. They'll just wait until that comes and do it on that. Same thing, like, if they're going to do something major with reconsidering AppKit or UIKit with Swift and with more, like a more Swifty model. If they're going to be doing that anytime in the next 5-10 years, they'll wait for that. You know, they're not going to do something in the meantime that is like, I can't imagine them investing tons of time and effort into a brand new Objective-C and Swift UI framework for the Mac today. Like that, I don't see that at all. If they have to do something more elegant, but they have to wait 5 more years to do it, they'll just wait.
Let's talk about something that's awesome and celebrate a little bit.
All right. Speaking of the Mac, if you are a Mac developer and you want to sell outside the Mac App Store, our first sponsor today is DevMate. DevMate lets you sell Mac apps outside of the Mac App Store, and it integrates a whole bunch of services so that you don't. So it kind of gives you a lot of the benefits of selling in the Mac App Store as a Mac developer, but without having to actually be in the Mac App Store. So, you know, and I was looking at maybe making a little Mac app, not Overcast, but maybe making a little Mac app, a little utility thing. Sorry, Casey. I was looking at it, and I honestly don't want to have to deal with payment processing, and I don't want to have to deal with like building in an auto updater and everything. Like, I just don't want to deal with that stuff. There's a reason why the App Store is compelling when it works well, which might be never, but when it like the promise of it is actually, you know, it should work, and in theory it does work. Unfortunately, in reality, the Mac App Store doesn't work. And fortunately for me, I don't need to make that decision for whatever this app is I'm going to make, because it can't be sandboxed, so I can't put it in the Mac App Store. So if I want to release it, I have to release it outside of the Mac App Store. And I'm looking at DevMate, honestly, because DevMate, so it's made by a company called MacPaw. They do all sorts of stuff for the Mac. They've made a powerful toolset that has allowed all of us Mac developers, I can say us now, to overcome App Store limitations. So they can sell your software outside of the Mac App Store. You can deliver updates easily to it with their platform. You can protect your apps with license management. You can make trial versions. You can sell bundles. You can even run beta tests with automatic crash reporting. All these luxuries that you get if you're totally in the App Store ecosystem. And you can get in-depth analytics and marketing metrics, which is even usually better than what you can get in the App Store. So DevMate has collected all the tools and services they use into one pack, and they've created this amazing platform for Mac developers. So you don't have to do any kind of crazy licensing coding to make your own like weird serial number scheme or anything like that. You can use their tools, manage free trials, and many different diverse license types. They offer hosting, they offer the CDN, version management, update delivery, and an e-commerce solution for in-app purchase. All these things all available. You can get customer feedback. You can view a breakdown of your paid and trial customers with built-in trial support. All this amazing stuff, all at DevMate. So all you have to do is worry about coding the app itself, and you leave the rest to DevMate. So Mac developers, check out DevMate today. Honestly, I am tempted by this. I might check it out. If I decide to release this app, that's going to be the first place I look, honestly. Anyway, thanks for sponsoring.
All right.
So you're not going to tell us what the app is?
Well, sure. It doesn't really matter. It's not. It's really nothing. It's like, do you remember a few months ago I posted a little like LaunchD Apple script thing to automatically quit Twitter every 10 minutes if it wasn't active? So if you make a native app, you can do that a lot better. You can do things like, you know, instead of just every 10 minutes, check if it's active and if not, quit it. You can monitor the active window in real time. And so you can quit it like 10 minutes after I last used it. And you can do, or you can do things like only quit if it's hidden and stuff like that. You can do like a more advanced version of this more easily. So I have a little prototype of that running, and right now it's literally like this giant black square in my menu bar. So that, you know, if I want to actually, you know, make it releasable, there's going to be some work involved, but it does work, and it's really nice. Actually, it's really nice. I found that this has dramatically reduced my Twitter usage, as measured by rescue time. And so I'm actually very happy with this approach. And it has turned Twitter into something that is always open on my Mac, like mail. You know, like it has turned it from something that's always open to something that is inherently incredibly unreliable, because it seems like, to me, like it crashes every 10 minutes, which is really nice.
It actually created your own chaos monkey on your Mac.
Yes. That only targets one or two apps. It's great. Yeah, it's great because like it turns it into something that I have to like actively go and activate, rather than something that's always there in the corner ready for me to be distracted by it, you know? So this approach actually does work really well for me. I don't know if it'll work for anybody else. I don't know if anybody else cares, but it was worth me making the Mac version just to make it better. So it's no longer these weird LaunchD scripts that I can't turn off easily or can't adjust easily. So I'm liking it. So I might release it. I don't even know if I would charge money. I have no idea. But I mean, I figure this could be like a nice way for me to learn a little more about making Mac software and the market for Mac software, and just kind of dip my toe in and get like a little tutorial on it.
Excellent.
Would you pay $5 for this thing?
No, I wouldn't buy it. No.
Yeah, I can't
you can
say
buy
I
an
would.
Application that quits out from under you. No thanks.
Yeah.
I don't even like sudden termination or whatever the APIs they added that, like, when you have no open documents, it kills the application. I don't even like that.
I haven't even noticed that ever hitting me, honestly. Maybe I just don't use apps that do it.
If you use TextEdit, it happens a lot. You close all the windows and TextEdit, and you switch to some other app, and then you look back at the doc, and you're like, oh, where'd that dot go underneath TextEdit? Oh, it's gone again.
who uses TextEdit anymore?
I find myself using it still occasionally. I use it as my poor man's outliner. Like, if you do Option Tab, you know, that whole thing.
Don't you have don't you have BB Edit? Aren't you like a better text editor person?
Yeah, but that's not for outlining. Like for outlining, really? Like having indented levels and being able to just keep typing and have it soft wrap the indented level. You know, like
you just hit tab. What?
No. You write long paragraphs and they stay at the level of the, like, you're not hard wrapping it, right? You're just typing and typing and typing, and it is wrapping in a paragraph, but that paragraph is indented just like the bullet point you put it on.
Use a task paper.
I don't even know what that is.
That's what I use for that. I think it's Jesse Grossjean, the guy who makes folding text. I think that's him.
Yeah. Anyway, text edit is what I use for my podcast notes when I'm on podcasts other than this one, like when it's just notes for me, as opposed to all three of us sharing a document, right? Yeah. And I don't know. And you know, you double click documents, it owns .txt, and I haven't gone and changed the bindings for all that stuff. So I find myself launching it. And then if I want to keep it open, I got to remember to just keep one document open. Really, like, the whole idea is you're not supposed to care that it's open. A text edit launches so fast, I really don't care. But I do notice it quitting itself. Preview does the same thing, which annoys me more, because I do use Preview more to like, view images and stuff.
Apparently, literally, Task Paper 3 was released today. Coincidentally. I've been testing it for a while, and I really like it. I didn't realize it was released today. Yeah, I like Task Paper a lot. So we'll put a link in the show notes.
Fun times. All right, so speaking of releasing things, Overcast 2.5. Tell us all the things about it, Marco.
Oh, geez, do I really have to? Yeah, so I did a 2.5 update, the list of features of which was typed in Task Paper the whole time, as I've been using it as my to-do list for all of my apps since Instapaper 1.0, maybe, or at least early versions of Instapaper. Anyway, 2.5 is basically what it sounds like. It's like a half major release. If that makes sense. Like there, it's not like it still looks about the same for the most part. There's not a whole lot of new headlining features, but there are a few, and there's a whole bunch of big improvements everywhere, basically. Like, so originally I was calling it 2.1, and I was like, as I kept adding more stuff, I'm like, you know what? This feels like a 2.5. So I'll call it 2.5. And it's about 6 months from 2.0, so that kind of made sense with a roughly annual release cycle for the big stuff. So the big things are, if you are a patron, so if you pay me $1 a month, basically, then you get a new dark theme, and you get the ability to have file uploads. So you can like upload something that's not a real podcast or not a public podcast, like an audiobook, or if you're a producer of a podcast, like a draft of an episode you're working on, you can upload that into Overcast and play it in your player. It doesn't become public for everybody to play. It just plays for you. And this is actually a feature. I built this in version 1.0. I had this right at the beginning, and it was only enabled for my account for all this time. And I would use it to play downloaded episodes of Howard Stern. I mean, personally recorded episodes of Howard Stern. Home Howard Stern recordings. And so I use it all this time, but I didn't want to launch it because these files are hosted on S3. And so I'm like, I don't really want to sign myself up for somebody paying me $5 once and then me hosting like 2 gigs of S3 files for them for the next 3 years. That would be hard to sustain economically. And so I figured, let me wait until I have some kind of recurring revenue in place, or if it appears as though the app is doing so incredibly well with the in-app purchase up front that I can enable it for everybody, then maybe I'll try it later. But anyway, whatever, I push it off till later. That was in mid-2014. I kind of just forgot about it. I mean, people have been requesting this feature for a while, but there were always features that were requested more that I had to do, that were more important to do, things like streaming and stuff like that. So there was always kind of stuff ahead of it in the to-do list, and I finally got around to doing it, and which really was just like polishing up the feature I already had, like making it look a little bit nicer, styling the website slightly around the uploader, instead of just being like an unformatted progress bar and everything. And the technical side of it's really pretty straightforward. I actually, if you look at this, if you view source on the uploads page, I actually am uploading the files directly to S3, and then the app downloads them directly from S3. So the files never pass through Overcast servers, which helps me save on cost, and it also helps them arrive faster. Like, you don't have to like wait for a double upload. Like, for my server, then upload it to S3, you don't have to wait for that. So it's both a nice cost savings for me and also a speed improvement for you, and a weird technical cool thing that most people don't even know that you can generate a form to securely upload a file to S3, but you can. Then I did dark mode, which is also for patrons only. I got a little bit of pushback on this, actually. I'd say I probably heard from about 100 people. It's a little controversial. I'm curious what you guys think. It's a little controversial because, so when I had version 1.x, like all the 1.x versions, it ran from mid-2014 to mid-2015, version 1 was a free app with a $5 in-app purchase to, quote, unlock everything. And what I meant was unlock all the features I have right now, like just unlock everything. And then in 2.0 last October, I switched to a full patronage model where everything was free, and you could pay if you wanted to for nothing. Like, you get nothing for it. And I said, like, I might add features in the future for patrons that I can't add for everybody for cost reasons or whatever. And I was actually thinking about the upload feature when I wrote that. So now, when I wanted to add this new file upload and dark mode pair, I decided to make both. Now, file uploads are easy to make patron only because you can say, well, that costs money for everyone who uses it. But there is a debate here among people who bother me on Twitter. People who are like, they're literally arguing with each other. Like, I'm not even involved in the argument. They're people, like, my people are arguing in my mentions with each other about whether this should be a problem or not. Whether people who bought it, who bought the 1.x unlock everything thing in 2014, whether they should have the dark mode as well. And so, what do you guys think about that? Because I figured the reason why I thought it would be okay this way, the reason I made everything free with 2.0. And decided to just do patronage for nothing for a while, was I was tired of the basic version of the app having like intrusive limitations that would make it suck. So like a limit on, like, it would only show the top 5 entries in a playlist, and you couldn't adjust the speed, or you could only do it for a few minutes at a time and everything. So there were these like these limitations in the app that were actively trying to make the app worse so that you would hit them, and then you'd be encouraged to pay the money to unlock everything. And so I decided that it would make most sense for, if I was going to do anything special for patrons, and first of all, I should preface this with, patronage wasn't going that well, honestly. Like, it was going well enough to sustain the basic cost of the app, but it wasn't doing well enough for me to really want to justify putting tons of time into it. It was doing okay, but I needed to do better than how it was doing. Otherwise, I'm going to have to move back to some other model, like, you know, whether it's paid up front or another in-app purchase, whatever. So patronage as it was going was not going well enough. So I had to change something. So I decided, let me give people some motivation to pay. But I didn't want to make the app suck for everyone else. So I decided to, dark mode was, I decided was interesting to make patron only because it's something that doesn't really, if you don't have it, it doesn't affect you at all, really. Like, it doesn't, the absence of this feature does not make the app worse for everyone who doesn't have it. It's not like some kind of limit that you hit where it makes it worse. So I figured it would be a nice perk to give patrons. It's something that, like, it kind of feels like a perk. It kind of feels like a special extra, you know? Because it isn't really like a substantial functional feature in the app. It's just like a theme. It's how it looks. And so you make a cool dark mode and it looks cool and everyone likes dark modes now. Like, so it looks cool and I think it looks nice and it's something new and different and kind of exclusive because it's patron only. So I thought that was all fine. But I have now heard from, yeah, probably about 100 people who think differently. What do you guys think?
It seems like, well, so for the patron thing, if someone pays and they get the dark theme, does the dark theme go away if they stop paying?
Yes.
So that, I think that's the place where it doesn't seem like it fits, because it seems more like an in-app purchase, basically. Like, if you did it as an in-app purchase, it would be, look, if you don't want dark theme, before 2.5 came out, you didn't have dark theme anyway. You didn't even know dark theme existed. You were fine using Overcast before. Now all of a sudden 2.5 comes out and you see the shiny dark theme that you want, but you don't want to pay for it. You just want to get it for free. Well, you know, if this is a thing that you like, how about you give me some money and I'll give you the dark theme? But I think that most people's minds, dark theme doesn't seem like a thing that you should have to keep paying for. They don't, you know, for whatever reason, it seems like buying a downloadable content in a game. You know, you buy to get the fancy hat for your character, you get the fancy hat. You don't have to keep paying every year to keep your fancy hat. I think it feels more like a one-time in-app purchase. And yeah, I think it's the perfect kind of in-app purchase or the perfect kind of monetary frill, because it's like I said, for the people may be upset about it, but you know, you're using 1.0 and 2.0 and they didn't have any dark theme, right? You before 2.5 that you were fine with it, but then suddenly when you know there's a dark theme and now you have to pay money to get it, oh, I want to get it. I want to get it for free. Well, so if you don't think it's worth the money, don't pay for it, right? And if you suddenly don't want to use the application, like, well, then just go back in time and pretend 2.5 was never released and then use whatever calculus you were using before to make you pay for it. Were you just holding on waiting for a dark theme? Anyway, what I'm saying is I don't think it seems like a recurring thing. And trying to bundle it all under the patron thing when you've only really got two things at this point for the patrons. You've got the uploads, which, like you said, makes total sense. Like, you're costing money, therefore you must give money on a regular basis because you're storing files on the internet, right?
Well, it doesn't make total sense to everybody who's been angry. At least half of them are demanding that too. But that one's easy for me to say. I can't do that for everybody. Sorry, I'm not going to do that. You know, that makes sense.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, like, it's just a money-losing proposition there. I will pay for storage on Amazon S3 for you, and you will give me nothing? No, it doesn't, you know. Anyway, I think that makes more sense. And if you had, like, 17 features that patrons got, and one of them happened to be the bundled dark theme, I think that would make sense, too, because the patron is, like, the different class of people. Like, oh, I pay a little bit extra. There's an app that you can get and use for free, and it does everything you want it to do, but I pay a little bit extra for this one feature that has an ongoing recurring cost because I'm storing bits on the internet, and this other feature that's just a little perk. I mean, in the end, it doesn't really matter, like, all these logical arguments of what should or shouldn't be. All that matters is, are people willing to pay for it? I mean, you'll find that out with the sales number. Have you made an offering that is attractive enough for people to part ways with their money on a regular basis to get them? You'll find out. But if we had to try to, like, break it down, I think that's the difference between the two, the things that you've offered, that one of them just doesn't seem like a recurring feature to a lot of people. But for other people, they're going to pay for the file uploads anyway. And for them, dark mode is just like a perk. Oh, and great, I get dark mode too. They don't feel like they're paying X amount every month or year for dark mode. They feel like they're paying for file uploads and getting dark mode as a perk. So I think that the sales numbers will bear it out. And if people are having arguments about it, it's clear there are disagreements about what is worth spending this money on or not. So I think it's a perfectly valid experiment, and I fully expect in 6 months or a year from now you to try more experiments, because that's just the way it goes.
Casey, what do you think?
I think that I didn't blink an eye over dark mode or file uploads being a patron-only exclusive. I think having heard John's thoughts on it, I tend to agree with him that dark mode seems like maybe it should have been an in-app purchase separate from the patronage. But then that gets into a whole new wiggly discussion about, well, do you really want to have patronage and in-app purchases concurrently?
And the answer is no, I really don't. Like, there's so many reasons why I don't want to do that.
Then I would say either you give dark mode out of the goodness of your heart and then potentially have some financial implications thereof, which I don't think is a terribly good option, or you deal with the people being grumpy. I do understand what John's saying, and I mostly agree with him that, you know, it feels like the sort of thing that you should just pay for once and that's that. But on the other side of the coin, I mean, you need to be able to eat. And I would say that most of the people, or I would think that most of the people that download this app have enough of an understanding of kind of how the App Store economy works, not necessarily to the level of those who listen to the show, but just a general understanding that, hey, the people who wrote this app or person that wrote this app needs to be able to eat. And so I need to be able to pay that person. I don't find it troubling for either to be in the patronage model at all, really. But it's easy for me to say because, you know, I'm obviously going to support you regardless because you're a close friend of mine. I definitely don't see a problem with the file uploads being in patronage at all. Because as John has said, and as you've said, you need to be able to recoup that money somehow.
The way I look at the patronage model, really, is that I'm trying to find a way to be both the cheapest and the most expensive podcast app in the store. I'm trying to find a way where this could be free for almost everybody, you know, and free up front. If anybody wants to try it, they can try it for free. Because, as I said, you know, on numerous other occasions, one of my goals with this app is to get a lot of users to kind of help me defend the openness of podcasting with diversity of clients. So it is very important for me that the app stay free up front. And so the question is, like, where do I get the money? You know, and I can do like ads somehow, but I don't really want to. I've thought of like ways I could do it tastefully. I still would rather not do that if I don't have to. So, you know, we'll see what happens there. Hopefully I won't need to do that. But I might. To me, I see this really as update pricing or upgrade pricing, like kind of baked in. So like if I didn't do this, I would have to do some kind of upgrade pricing model. So I would have to then, you know, hold back features for longer and make these bigger. Like, I probably wouldn't have released 2.5 right now. I probably would have waited a few more months and done a big 3.0 update in, you know, in the summer or something, and then charged a whole separate purchase. Like, had it be, all right, you know what, your 1.x and 2.x purchases don't count for anything now. Now, you know, brand new purchase for the 3.0 premium features. And that's also sucks for in a lot of different ways. Like, and I think that would anger people more. So the question is, I want to get some kind of recurring revenue. And I think the software industry kind of bears that out now of seeing, like, you know, for an app to be sustainable, it needs something like that. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be done in one particular way, but somehow you need recurring revenue to come in. You know, like with Instapaper, I didn't have that for a long time. Instapaper, it was just $5 up front, and that was it. And that worked for a long time because the growth was so good. With Overcast, the growth isn't that good. It grows, but it's not growing at the kind of rate that Instapaper was. Just because, you know, Instapaper had a really great growth curve. It was really early in the App Store. It had, you know, it was, you know, in the right place at the right time, basically. And I think that was a wider audience. Whereas now with Overcast, like, the built-in podcast app is so popular, and even though it's fairly mediocre, it's popular enough that, you know, it's hard for people to make a dent in that. So I need some way to – I can't rely on just growth for revenue purposes. I have to rely on some kind of recurring revenue. So in the App Store, my options are sell, like, you know, coins and BS, like some kind, but, you know, some kind of, like, consumable – you know, it's literally, like, you know, they call it some kind of consumable in-app purchase. I don't think that necessarily fits in a podcast client. I don't see how that fits in a way that doesn't just piss people off. So that's option number one, not a very good option. Option number two would be what I mentioned, kind of like the upgrade pricing kind of straightforward way to do it, which is either make a whole separate app every year and have it be paid up front maybe, or have it be, you know, free with in a purchase to unlock the way I did 1.0. then I have a whole new app every year. And that has so many problems with like people getting really angry if they bought it right before you updated it. And you have to like, again, you have to like kind of batch your major updates together and like, you know, hold back features for like 6 months waiting for the big update and everything. And that sucks too. Or you do what I'm doing now, which is like some kind of subscription, some kind of recurring payment for something. So the way I'm doing it now is, you know, I started out, you're paying for nothing. Now you're paying for almost nothing, except for, you know, these two features you're kind of paying for. I think it's a pretty good happy medium where I'm basically charging you $12 a year if you want the full experience, but most people won't, and that's fine. So far, my subscription counts are up by some big percentage, I think like 30% in like 2 days. I mean, they had a big jump, and we'll see what happens. If they keep going up as more people get the update or try the update. I'm not really promoting the update. Like when you launch it after the update, it doesn't pop up a box saying, hey, here's what's new. Just nothing happens. Like, so you'd have to like go to the settings screen to even notice necessarily that it's been updated. So this could be like a slow growth over time, but it does seem so far as though this one change of like giving you something that you kind of want for $12 a year, it does feel like that one change will be enough to push a lot more people into subscribing. And that will probably make the difference between being able to keep this model long term or not. Because if I didn't do this, as I said earlier, if I didn't add something compelling for patrons, and uploads aren't compelling enough because most people don't need that feature. Some people really like it, but most people don't need it. Whereas dark mode, that could appeal to any user. You know, it doesn't necessarily, not everybody cares that much, but it will appeal to lots of people. So if I didn't make a change like that, where something, you got something for that unlock that was really nice, but that didn't make the app super bad for everyone who didn't have it, then I wouldn't be able to continue this model. So, hey, we'll see what happens. John's probably right. I will probably change this in 6 months, but you know, I'm hoping not to have to, because if I can keep this, if this ends up working and being like a great model for Overcast long term, then I don't need to like save up features for major releases anymore. I can release features whenever they're ready. That is so much better for me. It's better for users. It is just so much better to do things that way. And I don't have to deal with all this crazy, like constantly changing purchase stuff to manage. And it's easier for the users. There's no issue of like, if you buy the day before I have like a major new update, then you feel like a jerk for having bought the day before. Like there's so many issues this avoids. And barring the absence of some kind of new App Store monetization method where, you know, if Apple would offer some kind of easier paid upgrade system or something, like then I might change my mind. But barring anything like that, which I don't foresee, this is probably a really great model as long as it works. That's a big question, but we'll see.
So you're going to have to come up with new hats soon, though. Like the dark mode is your hat. Or dark mode is that, you know, the games learn that the thing that you can make people pay for are actually the things that are meaningless in the scope of the game, but give your character a funny hat or whatever, you know, like some cosmetic item that is desirable all out of proportion to the actual value. Because the number of people who legitimately need dark mode because the white screen is too blinding and they like to use it mounted in their car or whatever, like there's, everyone's got an excuse why they need a dark mode and they can't turn their screen down or whatever, right? But bottom line is people want dark mode because it looks nice. Those are the perfect kind of usually, you know, in-app purchase types things. I would love to know how many people signed up for patronage in 2.5 because of one of the two new features. Which one was it? Like, if they had to weigh them. Like many people are just signing up just because they want to fund the app and have it be developed and blah, 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 that sort of high-minded ideal. But other people are like, oh, there's two new features, file uploads and dark mode. Which one were they really wanting to get? Did they like them both equally, or are they going mostly for dark mode? And I would think most of them were going for dark mode, even though that is like the less valuable, practically speaking, in terms of doesn't actually add any feature, just makes the app look different. So if that ends up working, next year you'll need something else of similar value for the people who paid for dark mode, right? To maybe they don't want to keep paying because they're bored with dark mode. What new hats do you have to give them for your podcast application? How about a podcast application construction kit, like the calculator construction kit? Get to design your own application, pick the font, pick the color. Anyway, I'm sure you'll come up with something. What I'm hoping is, though, as you go through these features, you're saying like before you had these other features that were more important than file uploads, but eventually you did those, and so you got down to file uploads. When are you going to get to, how far down the list is my pet feature where whenever I add something to Overcast, I want it to be added to the one playlist I use all the time? I hate adding it to Overcast and realizing I didn't really add it to Overcast. I added it to a place where I'm never ever going to see it because I spent all my time in this one playlist, and it's 7,000 taps to pull things from not in the playlist to be into the playlist when they're like individual episodes. Like if someone tweets, oh, this was a good podcast episode of a podcast that you probably don't want to subscribe to, but just download this episode. And before it was like, oh, well, now I got to subscribe and find the episode and then add it to my playlist. But now with uploads, I can just download the MP3 and upload it, but I still have to go add it to my playlist. I would love it if everything I added to Overcast always went into the playlist of my choice. And I realize that's a super low priority feature, but in theory, eventually you'll get to it.
That is exactly how Overcast works for me, because my like everything playlist is default inclusive. Yours is a whitelist based. So, right? Isn't that last time we talked about this?
But yeah, but that's what I want. That's what I want. I want it to be whitelist based because there are things on the outside that are large volume things that I don't want cluttering up my. It just seems like a simple. Anyway, eventually you'll be scraping the bottom of the barrel of the features and you'll get to mine.
Eventually.
It's just one top menu. When adding things to Overcast, where should they be added by default? I don't even want a million options of like what priority or whatever. Just add to the bottom. I don't care. Or the top, whatever. Pick one.
Oh, boy. Well, anyway, maybe someday I'll have to go ad-supported. But if I did, I would totally have MailRoute as a sponsor. One of our sponsors this week on the show is MailRoute. Go to mailroute.net/ATP. MailRoute is amazing hosted spam and virus email filtering. That's it. That's all they do. They do email, spam, and virus filtering. And they do an amazing job at it. I've used it myself for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, a while now. And it is shocking how little spam I get now and how few legitimate messages are caught in the spam filter. It's really quite good. MailRoute is great. Once again, mailroute.net/ATP. So if you are in the corporate world, there's all these products that like filter email for you, and there's things like Postini, MXLogic, these things that have been discontinued. This whole industry in the corporate world is full of these like ghosts that have just been discontinued, and then you're kind of stranded. MailRoute is here. They've been here for a long time. They are here to stay. This is all they do. They do spam and virus filtering. And there's no hardware to buy. This is a cloud service. So what you do is you point your domain name at MailRoute, and then you point MailRoute to your server, and they deliver filtered mail, only filtered mail, to your server. So if you're a corporate person, this saves you tons of hassle because you don't have to deal with all those like hardware filtering gateway things. And also, it saves tons of server load for you because you don't have your servers processing all the spam themselves. So big companies might be able to go from like 10 email servers down to 2 or something. It's crazy how much spam you have to process. And once you get rid of it, like your email servers are sitting there doing nothing. If you're an individual like me, then it's also really great because, you know, I don't run my own servers. I use Fastmail as my host. But this gives the world-class spam and virus filtering to any IMAP host. So if you have your own host like I do, your own domain name, you can, again, point the domain at MailRoute, point MailRoute to you, and then all of your spam just goes away. And there's lots of cool tools to help you manage this. They'll send you like an email digest of like things that were caught in the spam filter that they think might not be spam, that kind of need a threshold. And you can, with one click, you can whitelist any of them that come through and have them be redelivered if they got anything wrong, although they usually don't, honestly. That's a really great service. Check it out today. They've been doing, the team behind MailRoute has been doing email protection since 1997. That's even older than I've been using cellular modems. It's a very, very long time. The interface has tons of admin tools. If you're a corporate person, if you need like, you know, any kind of like granular access tools or, you know, corporate friendly things like that, they offer all that stuff. They even have price matching right now for any McAfee or MXLogic customers. Start today with a free 30-day trial of MailRoute. Go to mailroute.net/ATP or email sales@mailroute.net. Listeners of this show, using our coupon code, or by going to mailroute.net/ATP, will get 10% off for the lifetime of your account. So every time they bill you, you get 10% off if you sign up through our link, mailroute.net/ATP. Thanks a lot to MailRoute for sponsoring our show.
One quick question for you, Marco. I don't know very much at all about S3, but all of the uploaded files are in a bucket that you control/own, right? Or maybe bucket
Yes.
isn't the right term. But so have you looked into about how many files have been uploaded? Is it a gajillion? Is it just 10? You know, do you have any feeling for it?
Honestly, I haven't looked since that day. Give me a second. Introduce the next topic, and I'll look. Can I do this? Can Transmit count up for me?
Well, while you think about that for a second, and you can interrupt with some real-time follow-up, hopefully in a minute, it is probably worthwhile for us to talk about what's going on Monday. It is Monday, right? The Big Apple event?
Something like that, yeah.
I think it's March 21st. So, yes, that's Monday. Apple is going to loop in the press on March 21st and talk about some new things. What do we think it's going to be? I presume it'll be some sort of new Macintosh hardware. It may be a new smaller iPhone, which I have extraordinarily conflicting thoughts about. John, what do you think?
I haven't really been keeping up with the typical Kremlinology of examining the invitation and seeing what it means. I mean, I did see it when it came out, and I thought briefly about the looping you in, and I saw a couple stories about, oh, it's going to be showing new colors of Milanese loops. I don't know. I mean, the titles always mean something. Sometimes it's something not exciting. But that's, it does say something about what they choose to emphasize. And it would be really weird to me, I think, to have this event where we assume there's going to be at the very least new laptops that Marco will talk about when he's done doing his research.
it's just a spinner. I'm not counting it myself.
But, it would be really weird to me if they had this event and introduce all the things that we think they're going to introduce, or at least some of them or whatever, but the loop us in thing ended up being about new Milanese loops, new colors. Like, I don't know. It seems weird. So I'm hoping that's not what it is. But anyway, I've been treating this event kind of like The Force Awakens, where I'm not trying to read too many spoilers about it, because the past couple events I haven't really been bowled over by. And I want to be pleasantly surprised by something. So, you know, it's just managing expectations. Like, all right, well, if you feel like you're getting overhyped, then just don't read as much hype. And then whatever they announce, you'll be more excited about.
Can I spoil it for you?
I mean, yeah. So the laptops, I'm probably not going to be excited about anyway.
Well, I was just going to tell you that they're probably not going to release the Mac Pro with the gaming video card that you want.
Oh, yeah. No, really? Thanks. I kind of figured that one out. Doesn't have to be a gaming video card, but they released a new Mac Pro, period. Yeah. I'm assuming if that's going to come, it would be WWC or later. I haven't even been keeping up to know if this is the rumored event where they're going to do the new iPad. I assume that's going to be October still, but like the new regular size iPad with the stylus and everything that I might actually buy. But if they did announce that, because I've been out of the loop, I would be excited by it, and I would probably buy one. Otherwise, I guess I'll just look at the laptops from afar, and we'll talk about whether we think they're good or bad laptops. But Marco can tell us about those now.
Well, first of all, the rumors are pretty strong that this is the event where the 9.7-inch new iPad will be released.
Oh, no, you don't spoil it for me. I could have been pleasantly surprised.
How do you not know that?
I've been trying to stay away from, you know, the million sites that will tell me the list of things that are likely to appear.
Okay, well, basically, everybody is reporting the same rumors, including ATP Tipster, reporting the same rumors that basically, this is that event, and we should probably expect that to happen, like, you know, almost certainly. I don't think anyone's even doubting any part of it anymore. But basically, that's going to happen in all likelihood. And it is 9.7-inch iPad that's kind of like a mini iPad Pro. So it'll have a smart connector. It'll have those four speaker arrangement. And it'll be nice and fast and use some variant of the A9X. Right. Oh, and it supports the Pencil.
I've been wondering how they're going to find space for the big speaker cavities. Do they just mean they'll have four speakers?
That is the rumor, is that it will have a similar four speaker arrangement as the iPad Pro. I think they could plausibly do it. I mean, with the iPad, their main limitation is weight. It's not necessarily size. Weight is the big one. So like they presumably, like, I don't think every inch of that case needs to be full of battery. You know, because I mean, look at the iPad Pro. You know, if you look at the iPad Pro, it's not.
But the case is so much bigger. There is what I don't know. I think it's just make it thicker, obviously. But that's so counter to what they always do. Like, all you got to do is make it a millimeter thicker, and then suddenly you gain back all the area that you want or you could just make the cavity smaller. Anyway, I'm sure they'll work it out. I'm just curious about what it'll look like.
But a real time follow up: the total amount of data stored in an Overcast upload so far is 189 gigs. So that's not bad for like 3 days after release.
Well, that is impressive. And do you have any feel for how many files that is? Just ballpark?
This doesn't tell me that.
It tells me exactly
how many bytes. Yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah, a lot. 188 gigs. I mean, I have a limit of 500 megs per file. So it's probably, or maybe, no, I've raised it. It's a gig per file now. So, you know, it's got to be at least 188. So, probably more. Anyway, so I think this will be a major iPad update because, for one thing, I think bringing the Pencil to the 10-inch line is a really big deal. And by all accounts, that's what they're going to do. That is going to be huge because for so many people, they really want the Pencil, but the iPad Pro is just too big. Because the iPad Pro, like, you really have to be like really into working on the iPad, like on a table or at a desk. Like, you have to be really into that kind of setup, like a, almost like a mini laptop, really. You have to be using it that way for that to be comfortable for a lot of people. The way most people use iPads, kind of like in one arm, like kind of sitting like on a couch or something, like, the way most people use iPads, I think, that the iPad Pro is not great for that. You can do it, but it's really not great for that. And in some cases, maybe you can't do it. So I think there's a lot of people who would like the features of the iPad Pro, but just want it to be smaller. And, you know, just for physical dimension reasons. So I think this will sell very well for an iPad. I don't think it's going to revive the iPad and save it, you know, by itself. It might be part of a combination of things that revive the iPad, but I don't think this alone will do it. But I think it's going to be a really nice update, and it's going to be a success, I think. And if I use my iPad more than zero times ever, I would totally get it because it looks like it's going to be really good. Unfortunately, and maybe, you know, I might get it. I mean, I had an idea for an app that uses the Pencil, but I don't think, like, I'm probably not going to get to that idea anytime soon. So I'll probably wait on that and probably not get this version. But the only thing that would make me get this version, I think, is if I decided to move forward with that app and I would get it to test on, but it's probably not going to happen.
I'm really hoping for, even though I am not at all in the market for a laptop, I am really hoping for the new MacBook Pros or whatever else happens to be released has the keyboard mechanism from the Magic Keyboard. If you happen to follow me on Twitter, I won't shut up about how much I love the Magic Keyboard, because guess what? I'm so amped for the thought of that keyboard being on a MacBook Pro, because now typing on my basically brand new, as I sit here today, 15-inch MacBook Pro, the keys are just mushy by comparison to the Magic Keyboard, and I want the Magic Keyboard in a MacBook Pro. Some fears.
Yeah, so I guess we'll talk about the MacBook Pro now.
There anything else about the iPad?
No, but there's also the iPhone and the watch bands. Anyway,
we'll get there.
Yeah, so MacBook Pro. Intel released Skylake chips this past winter, like in CES or whatever time scale that was, or, you know, in that ballpark. Skylake is a big deal, basically. It's the new revision of the Intel CPUs that is dramatically lower battery life, or dramatically less battery usage, and a pretty decent performance increase as well. So it ends up that if you know, by switching to Skylake, if you keep the size of the thing the same, you can get a nice long battery out of it. If you just want to keep the battery life the same, then you can shrink the size of the laptop. You can make it thinner and lighter. So what we've heard from ATP Tipster, quite a lot actually, but yeah, you know, what we've heard is that this update or some update soon, like basically like these laptops exist. We don't know if they'll be released on Wednesday, but this update has happened internally and they're like done. They're ready to go. So. But, you know, with Intel, you never know, like, whether they can get enough chips and whether Intel's a mess as a partner to depend on, because, like, Intel's been holding back Mac releases for years now, because just, like, they just can't advance their own stuff, they can't get their process up, they can't get yields up, whatever else. But sometime very soon, and probably at this event, there's going to be a significant update to the MacBook Pro line, including, and also the MacBook One. So moving them all to Skylake, basically. And of course, what this allows them to do, as I said earlier, is you can either increase the battery life or you can make the thing thinner and lighter. So according to ATP Tipster, the MacBook One, the little skinny one-port thing with the crappy keyboard, that is apparently getting Skylake, but with, you know, not really other meaningful changes. The USB-C port it has will become a Thunderbolt 3 USB-C port, I think. But that will be a big deal because, you know, that enables faster things and better monitor and stuff like that. But the main thing is with the MacBook One, it'll get a decent performance increase. But again, keep in mind, you know, if a lot of people are hoping for the MacBook One to somehow reach the level of like last year's MacBook Pro or something, it won't. It can't. The thermal differences there, like, this is a fanless computer made to dissipate like 6 watts of heat or whatever. It's not, it can't you can't put a CPU class that's made for like a 25 watt enclosure. It can't dissipate enough heat. So the MacBook One CPUs are never going to be fast relative to the ones you can get by going a little bit larger with a fan. Like, they're never going to be that fast. And it's never even going to be close. They just can't be by just thermals of CPU design. But it will be probably, you know, a good, you know, 10 to 25% faster than it is now, something like that, like in that ballpark. And it's also going to probably have something like 10 to 30% better battery life, something like that. So it takes this computer that was pretty underpowered and had pretty mediocre battery life, and it makes those things better. You know, not 100% better, but decently better. So the MacBook One will get a little better. I would also speculate, I haven't heard anything about this yet, but I would also speculate, on the invitation to the event, the invitation Apple sent out, I know we don't want to look too much into it, however, it is pretty obvious on the invitation that they have clearly featured the colors of the metals they've been offering on the iPhone. They have the space gray, the rose gold, the gold, and the aluminum. They have all those colors, like, kind of forming the logo on the invitation. So I have to imagine this indicates that they're going to offer these colors on the new laptops. Notably, they don't currently offer the rose gold. They don't offer rose gold MacBook Ones yet. And they don't offer any colors on the MacBook Pros yet. It would be cool if they offered all four colors on all the MacBook Pros. And according to ATP Tipster, that might be the case. So I'm looking forward if they do that. I would love to have those color options, or more color options, but I would love to at least start with those. That would be, it'd be great to just have something different from the plain aluminum that we've seen for God knows how long, right?
Oh, totally. I bought my first Mac when the polycarbonate MacBook was a thing. And I remember wanting the, what people called the black book, which is basically a black plastic MacBook. I wanted that thing so badly, probably because I came from ThinkPads that were all black. But to this day, I still think it looks really, really, really good. And I wanted it so bad, but it was like $150 or something like that. The only difference was the case.
And it collected fingerprints like crazy. Like, that was,
oh, that I did not know.
Neither, yeah. We had a couple of them in the Tumblr office. A few people had them. I got to see them, like, during that time. And they never looked good in person. Because, like, and neither, you know, the white ones would have the discoloring palm rests. And it wasn't actually from your hands, necessarily. They would actually, the plastic would discolor with heat. And it would also discolor if you had your hands all over it and they were dirty. But, like I got my top case replaced in the middle of having my white MacBook. With the replacement, I put a little, like, one of those little, like, stick-on protectors on it. Like a clear stick-on protector on it. So my hands never actually rested on it, and it's still discolored. And yeah, it turns out, like, the, you know, as we learned with the white iPhone being delayed for like almost a year, remember that? As we learned, making white plastic that ages well and stands up to heat is really hard. And they just didn't do it right, or, you know, they hadn't figured it out yet. So yeah, the black one had a different finish. The white one had like a glossy, you know, smooth finish. The black one was like this weird matte, almost rubbery finish, and it just showed the slightest hint of finger oil, just from like picking it up, you'd have these giant oily fingerprints visible on the case. It was really not good. it was unfortunate, because like when it was perfectly immaculate, it did look really nice, but that lasted like a day, and then that was it.
The aluminum ones had the same problem back in the day. Like, I have one of the later non-unibody, before any unibody Apple portables came out, aluminum, and that aluminum would get these weird smudges. Like, they didn't wipe off. They would end up, like, discoloring the aluminum from oils on your fingers or from just kids' grossness. Like, you couldn't wash it off, and it was it was not great. And the new ones, like, on the MacBook Air, I know, because my kids' grimy hands are all over these things, and now the kids have graduated up to, or the computers have graduated down to the kids. Like, now they're using the old MacBook Air, and it just, even though it's the same color, it's the same boring silver that it's always been, it stands up better to finger grease and grime. And I think the current crop of the space gray or whatever, the darker color one, that one seems like it should hold up even better. I think they finally figured out how to make a surface, aluminum surface, that's durable and doesn't discolor, and then different colors of it, like the gold and the space gray, only improve that, because the hardest one to get is the one that's like the lightest or the closest to white, which is the plain old silver. So even if I hadn't seen rumors about this, which I had, I would have fully expected, just because the MacBook One is available in those colors, they'll all be available in those colors, because it's all just aluminum, and they're making a million things anodized in different ways, and I think they've really got the anodizing and the surface treatment of this aluminum down at this point, that they totally should do that. And I don't know if they're going to charge more for them. They didn't with the MacBook One, and unlike the BlackBook, which was whatever, you know, like you said, $150. It's just a way to make them more attractive machines. And if they have a pink one, that will definitely help, because that, like, that's the first sort of non-boring color. There's the other ones are like, all right, well, there are shades of gray and a gold that barely looks gold. Like, I would like a red one, a blue one, a yellow one. You know, we used to have multicolor iMacs and they were fun and we loved them. Now, you know, we're kind of timidly dipping our toe into colors that are not just different shades of silver or brown.
And also, you know, just like the actual design of the MacBooks has changed so little, you know, in the last 10 years. It really, going through the unibody transition and then going from unibody to Retina, it still just kind of looks like the same laptop, just, you know, thinner. You know, like it still looks very similar. I think they look good. You know, I think the current design does look good, but it's pretty boring by now. It's everywhere. And you know, as Apple has gotten more popular, this issue's even gotten worse, because I kind of feel like I want some room for individuality. And I know I'm not going to get a huge amount of that, especially if I buy a space gray one and show up to an Apple conference. Like, I know I'm not going to get that much individuality there. But I would like just something to push us a little in that direction. You know, anyway, if ATP Tipster is right, there's also substantial updates to the MacBook Pro. And this, to me, is more interesting, because the MacBook One we've already seen, I've already decided it's not for me. A lot of people have decided that, or that it is for them. And the update to the MacBook One is probably going to be a fairly minor one, whereas the update to the MacBook Pro is, if he's right, rumored to be substantial. And this is going to be a significant design update, because Skylake has enabled the laptop to become thinner and lighter, because, you know, they're going to shave off the quote excess battery. Because I love the concept of that, but, you know, I'm pretty sure that's how they look at it. And, you know, you could argue whether it is or is next. I'm sure I will argue that eventually again. But I expect, based on the information here, I expect that the new MacBook Pro will look like the MacBook One. Just, you know, not that small, obviously, but it has similar styling. So also offered in the colored metals, a thinner design, probably not tapered, but a thinner design using Skylake chips. I would expect roughly the 13-inch MacBook Pro to be effectively a replacement for the 13-inch Air at this point. You know, when they introduced the MacBook One, fans of the Air were very disappointed, because it seemed as though they were probably not going to ever touch the Air again, and that the long-wished-for Retina Air was probably not going to happen, that the MacBook One is the Retina Air. And that seems, you know, so far that seems to probably be correct. But the new MacBook Pro, the 13-inch, if you shave off, 20% of the weight of a 13-inch or whatever, or, you know, if you shave off a significant chunk of that weight, then, and make it a little bit thinner, then the 13-inch MacBook Pro is very close to the size and weight of a 13-inch Air. And it's Retina, and it's newer and more modern. And so, you know, supposedly, that sounds really good. Like, if that's all true. And the rumor is also that it retains the same ports. So, you know, it's not like going to lose, you know, tons of ports. It's going to retain the ports and just trade in the Thunderbolts for the for new USB-C Thunderbolt 3 ports. And if that's true, that's great. That sounds like a great laptop. Like, the 15 or the 13, they're both, you know, Tipster says they're both going to be like that. I would love either of those, honestly. The 13 would be a fantastic replacement for the MacBook Air, at least the 13-inch version of the MacBook Air. 11-inch Air fans, I'm sorry, you're screwed. You got to deal with the MacBook One. But if you're a fan of the 13-inch Air, I think the 13-inch Pro, then, you know, if this is all true, that will be awesome. Like, that'll be a fantastic all-around laptop. It'll be thin and light and powerful, and will have a Retina screen and tons of ports for usefulness. That sounds great. The 15-inch will also become even more compelling. You know, if this all works out, then the 15-inch, you know, kind of like drops itself by like half a weight class, basically. So it becomes even thinner and lighter, and, you know, and it's already, you know, the current 15 is already pretty good for a 15-inch. This becomes even thinner and lighter. I really hope this is all true. I would love to see this come out next week. If not, we'll probably have it at, you know, WWDC maybe, or sometime between now and then. But if you look at what's in this event, you have the new iPad, and then you have what we haven't talked about yet, which is the new 4-inch iPhone. Those are both kind of like mid-grade to low-end products. Oh, and also new watch bands, but not even, and possibly a minor update to the watch, but probably not even that. You kind of have like all these kind of low-end, low-profile products. I'm hoping the MacBooks are what makes the event kind of complete then. You know, the MacBooks and the MacBook Pros would be like, this is, it isn't just all boring low-end stuff. It's also, hey, here's some new stuff for the laptops that you're all using. You know, here's significant new versions of all the, of these laptops. I hope that's what's going on here. Now, about that 4-inch iPhone, what do you guys think about that? John, would you, you know, you used a 4-inch device for so long. Would you get a 4-inch iPhone?
I can't go back now, I think. I've been thinking about it, and like, and we have enough little iPod touches around the house. Like, in some ways, I miss the portability, but I'm just so used to the big screen now. I don't think I can go back. It's the iPhone 6 does still feel a little bit unwieldy in my pocket, but I don't. If I went to a store and I, you know, my 2 years was up and I needed a new phone, I think I'd pick the 6 size. So I am a convert, but I would assume that they are going to offer the smaller phone, and that the smaller phone will be cheaper, in keeping with the trend that the Plus is more expensive than the 6. The smaller phone will be less expensive than the 6 size devices, probably out of proportion to the cost savings that they get from using a smaller screen, right? Because they do get some cost savings from using a smaller screen and a smaller battery, and like all that stuff does cost less, but not, you know, not that much less. I think that this will be the lowest end of the current generation of iPhones, which is kind of a shame for the people who are hoping for the best that Apple could pack into a small package, but I think they're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny because I definitely wanted all the new insides when I got the 6 I guess 2 years ago now. But I really didn't want a bigger phone. And to this day, the phone doesn't feel bad in my hand, but we use a 5S as like a noisemaker when Declan is sleeping. So I handle a 5S at least once a day. And oh man, does that feel so much better in my hand? It feels perfect in my hand. It really does. And I think that's 95% size and a little bit the edges, but mostly it's the size. The problem though is that I don't know if I can go back from a phone that's got this much screen real estate. And so I think, like John, I probably am a permanent convert. I mean, I'm not a maniac. I'm not going to go Plus Club, but I think I'm a permanent convert in the 6 size category. But gosh, I'm going to have a real crisis of decision making when they show us something that looks really pretty, but is the same size as a 5S.
I have high hopes for this phone, even though I don't plan to get one. I'm glad that it's even rumored, that it looks like it's very likely to happen. I'm glad that they care about the 4-inch size. The iPhone 6 and 6 Plus sizes are good for a lot of people, but not everyone. And to totally abandon the 4-inch line, I think, would have been a mistake and would have really made life a little less convenient for a lot of people. So I'm really glad they're doing this. I'm very happy that we're going to have these options in the lineup again for people who do want them. And I'm glad that the option isn't just going to be like, oh, you can choose either like a new giant phone or an old piece of crap. Because it seems like the gap between, if the rumored specs are correct, it's going to basically be a mini 6S with maybe a little bit lower clock speed for thermal reasons. But it seems like it's going to have current generation hardware for the most part. You know, we'll see. I don't think we know really what the camera is going to be yet. It probably won't be as good as the 6 just for size or cost reasons, but it's probably going to be close, you know, and so I think it's going to be a really nice product for a lot of people, and I'm glad Apple's going to have it in lineup. I do think, you know, John, you know, you talked about this a little bit. I do think it is kind of unfortunate that Apple charges by size, so by pricing, they are going to have to make this like the lowest spec phone in addition to the, you know, the kind of smallest one in the lineup. It does kind of suck that people who get the small phone are probably never going to have the best hardware, but it'll be better than using, you know, 2-year-old, 3-year-old hardware. So, you know, overall, pretty good. I'm looking forward to it. Design-wise, I'm totally with you guys. I really don't care for the 6 physical design at all. I think, and the 6S made it slightly better by making the finish on the case slightly less slippery, but not enough. I really do not like the little slippery bar of soap design. I don't like that I have to use a case now. I use Apple's leather case now just to give it grip. I don't like cases. I don't like having all the dust collect around the edge. I don't like the extra bulk that they add. I don't like spending another $40 every time I buy a new phone. Cases are a really inelegant solution. And I know lots of people use them, and that's fine. But surely it's better if you design a phone that doesn't need a case for so many people. Some people are going to use a case regardless. A lot of people are going to use a case regardless. I didn't use a case for any of my phones before this, and it was fine. And the 6 and the 6S, I need a case to hold them securely. And that kind of sucks. I'm hoping with the iPhone 7 design this fall, I'm hoping that it improves the real-world holdability somehow. I'm honestly not that hopeful that it will.
I'm not as down on the 6 shape. In fact, I kind of wish that I could use it without a case because it's so nice to have the curved glass and the case messes that up for edge swipes and stuff like that.
Oh, yes.
But on the other hand, I really like my leather case. I like the fact that it is protected by this thin layer of stuff that can get nicked up and that I can replace that and that it's grippy because the leather is way more grippy than anything aluminum is ever going to be. And I like that. That's why I always use silicone cases for such a long time. I like the grippiness. But if a 7 is like this, because I'll be getting a 7, my 6 will, my 2 years with my 6 will be up, and I'll end up getting a 7. And if it's more or less like the 6, but improved insides, I'm fine with it.
So important question to go back to the 4-inch phone. Does it or does it not have a camera bulge?
I'm going to think no, right? You got to not have one.
It depends. So the reason I bring up the 7 also now is so we have this release that's literally halfway between the 6 and the 7 or the 6S and the 7 design releases. This phone, obviously, they're going to want it to be in the lineup for a while. They're not going to want, they're not going to make it look outdated in 6 months, ideally. So I'm guessing, so you figure, will the design of the new 4-inch phone more closely resemble the 6S or the 7? Or the 5S. Yeah, that was one of the early rumors. I don't see that.
Well, because the 5S didn't have a bulge, so that's what makes me think that if they're making a new 4-inch phone, the only reason you need the bulge is we need to have the best camera, and the best camera is just too big to fit. If it's too big to fit, they just won't give you the best camera. And they're going to have a non-bulging camera on the 7, it seems like, so they could even put that in there if they want to have the good camera. It just seems like their non-bulge options are so many. including actually making the thing a little bit thicker, because hey, this isn't the fanciest one. It's a little bit thicker. It could still be thinner than the 5S and still not have a bulge. I feel like the bulge days for this class are probably over, and the only reason the iPod Touch still has it is because no one cares about the iPod Touch and because the iPod Touch is insanely thin.
I hope that it doesn't have a bulge, but I'm really curious to see will the design of the new 4-inch phone give us any hints towards the design of the 7, basically? Will it indicate kind of where they're going? Or is it just, going to look old? Or the 6 design, I think, is ugly, certainly. I think it has very little personality. If you look at almost every previous iPhone, except maybe the 3G, if you look at all the other ones, I think they have a more distinct look. If you look at the 6, I think it looks like every Android phone. And part of that's because Android's been copying Apple like crazy. But part of that is also just there's less about the 6 that is visually distinctive. Whereas the 5 and the 5S, these were these beautiful, pretty unique looking objects. And the 4 before that, again, this really unique, double glass kind of thing. These were really distinctive looking objects. The 6 just isn't distinctive. It just looks like a blob, and it feels like a blob, and the back I think is ugly.
I like the 6 look better than the 5. I never liked the 5 design. It just seemed like a boring tub of aluminum. Chamfered edge was not enough to redeem it for me, just aesthetically. And I think the 6 was not the first phone to use curved glass at the edge. Many other phones, including Android phones, did that first. But I think Apple was wise to pick that up. The reason I think the 6 looks better is because I like both the appearance and the feel of the glass curving into the rest of the case. And the back of it doesn't look that impressive, but I don't think it has to. I think it's pleasingly smooth. I think they did an admirable job of blending in those weird antenna lines. That looks expensive and fancy to me, even if aesthetically it doesn't look particularly nice. If this case is to be believed, they've changed that antenna line to look a little bit more swoopy and a little bit less utilitarian. But we don't know what the front of it looks like. I assume it looks the same, but I think you can change the look of the front by, I mean, adjusting chin sizes, or, you know, you could do much more interesting things with the front of the iPhone than they're currently doing now. And the back of it, they're anodizing it in various colors, all of which are very subtle. I would say the same thing. I mean, I've been saying this for years that, you know, and I like the 5C. I like the fact that they offered it in a bunch of rainbow colors. Why can't you do that for the expensive phones? Why do you have to choose between the fastest insides or the fun colors? There, you know, we all know one or two people who ended up getting a 5C, at least partially because it's a more fun color. And sometimes they would sacrifice. They would say, well, I know it's not as fast and I would really like the faster one, but I really want to have a yellow phone because it looks cool. Like, the 5C was its own case, and I thought that was interesting and fun, and the top-end phones still don't do that. So I think there's plenty of room to visually differentiate, but if this one just ends up being a nicer 6, I will be fine with that, and I think the market will be fine with it, too.
Yeah, I feel like I'm between you guys in that I definitely think that the 5 looked great and is probably my favorite of all the iPhone designs, but the 6 looks really good, and I made the tragic mistake of taking my 6S out of my case as you guys were talking, and now I'm holding it naked in my hands. And
don't spill water on it.
I will attempt not to. This phone does. I mean, I like the leather case a lot. I've had Apple leather cases since I can remember, pretty much since they were offered. But this phone without a case on it does feel really good in the hand, in that it's more. It's both more and less comfortable, right? Because it's more comfortable in that the edges are a little easier on the hand, but it's less comfortable in that it's bigger. In fact, it's a little too big if I'm trying to reach from with my right hand from the bottom right where my thumb is all the way up to the upper left. And the I don't even remember what it's called, the little mode where everything kind of drops down a little bit where you double
reachability.
Yes, that's right. That is just such a hack. But
yes.
I don't know, it's tough because I both love and wish for less in the 6, but I don't think I could go back to a smaller screen. I really don't.
Yeah, I don't think I could either. I mean, like it once you, it's like when you move up monitor sizes on your computer, like it's really hard to ever move down. I think the same thing with the phone, if not even more so, because just how often you use a phone. I think once you move up to a big screen size, I think moving back down would. You could probably get used to it after like a week, but during that week, you'd be regretting every single minute getting that phone. And you might return it or, you know, I don't know. I think moving back would be difficult, but not impossible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the fact is, like, I'm actually thinking about getting the Plus in the next generation.
You're an animal.
Because, as I said, Mike might have been right.
This is how we're going to get you into an iPad. Your phone is just going to keep getting bigger and bigger until realize you're holding a 15-inch iPad Pro, and you're like, boy, this phone seems really big.
Yeah. Well, let me explain my possible Plus lust in a minute. But first, our final sponsor this week is Backblaze. Go to backblaze.com/ATP for amazing online backup. It's unlimited, unthrottled, and just uncomplicated. Simple online backup with unlimited space for $5 per month per computer. So I use Backblaze. My wife uses Backblaze. My mom uses Backblaze. I know so many people who use Backblaze so happily. It is a great service because it is just exactly what it says. It is online backup that just works really well and is really affordable. So this is one of the few things in computing where like unlimited truly means unlimited. It's, you know, it's per computer. So it's whatever drives you can connect to your computer. If you can connect a drive to your computer, Backblaze will back it up. And they have over 150 petabytes of data backed up from their customers. They've restored over 10 billion files. They can access your data anywhere. So if you, let's say you're on a trip. I do this actually probably a few times a year where I'll be on a trip. I will need a file from my home computer. I used to do this a couple weeks ago. And I can just log into Backblaze. I don't have to worry about my computer being on, trying to use like the back to my Mac thing, because that honestly I've never had that work reliably. try to do all this stuff. Backblaze, you just log into Backblaze, you select which files you want off your computer, and then like 2 minutes later, it emails you a zip file, and that's it. And you have your files. If you want, you can do all sorts of other restore methods as well. You know, if you need to restore one or two files, yeah, just do web restore. If you want to restore your entire like multiple terabyte hard drive, you can actually have them mail you a USB hard drive with all your stuff on it. It's really, they cover you in all these different ways. They have, you know, if you want encryption, they have encryption, like, you know, where you keep the key. There's no weird, like, add-ons or weird charges or anything like that. $5 per month per computer for unlimited, unthrottled online backup. And trust me, you want online backup. And if you're going to use online backup, I do suggest Backblaze. It's the one I use, and they're great. I like them a lot. Get a risk-free, no credit card required trial by going to backblaze.com/ATP. Thanks a lot to Backblaze for sponsoring our show. So, 7 Plus, or Pro, whatever. The rumors keep swirling that it might be called iPhone Pro, or there might be another model called iPhone Pro.
What's Pro about it, though? Like, I guess the cameras are better. But other than that...
And it's big. I guess with the iPad, they're going to confuse what that means. But the reason I'm tempted to do this, and we'll see what... I mean, obviously, we don't know anything about this product yet, except that it probably will exist and that it might contain a cool dual camera system that the smaller phone won't have. If that's all true, and if it doesn't really suck for some other way, some other reason, I'm tempted to get it because, A, I don't use an iPad. B, I use my phone for so much. Like, my phone is really my main computer for so much of the day, for so many parts of my life, while I'm traveling, while I'm just running errands around town, while I'm just in different parts of my house and not in my office. My phone is my computer for so much of every day. I do so much on my phone. And there are often times when I wish for a little more screen space. There are frequently times when I wish for more battery life, and there are frequently times where I wish I could type a little bit more accurately. And I've found in my brief times using a 6 Plus, like on a couple of trips I've taken it on, I have found that I can type more accurately because the keys are larger on that phone. It seems like my iPhone typing scales up in accuracy with size, where like I tried using a 5S the other day for testing, for when I was doing Overcast testing, and I was a mess on that keyboard. Like, I don't know how I ever typed on those keyboards before. And on the 6, I'm okay. But on the 6 Plus, I'm way more accurate. So I think it just kind of fits the way I thumb type better. So I think I could actually do a lot more while I'm away from my computer if I use the 6 Plus, if I use the plus size phone instead of the regular size phone. Plus, you know, when I have used it, I've been very happy with those benefits. My only reservations are that also when I've used it, I've been really turned off by how big it is in my pocket. So that's something I would have to consider. But I don't know. You guys sound like you're pretty set on not going the plus size.
Wait, can we just back up? So you're saying that you really, really, really love the feel of a 4-inch phone, but you're probably going to get the 17-inch phone for your next phone.
He just needs to have all three. And so depending on his mood at the moment, he just needs to get those, you know, those tactical pants with the really big pockets in them so he can have all three. And depending on, do I feel like typing more efficiently? Do I want to have a little worry stone that I rub in my hand? I'll pull out the 4-inch phone. Do I want to have the in-between size? I'll pull out the 6. That's the only solution for you, apparently.
Oh, my goodness. I do not want to hear Mike's feedback for this episode. I'm already dreading it.
What would you think if the 7 Plus had a smart connector on it?
I don't buy that for a second. So
now I'm not saying that I think that's going to happen, but like, what would you think of that product? Is that product more valuable to you, less valuable to you, or the same and you think it's just silly?
Well, look at what the smart connector does so far. So the rumor of the new iPad is that it will also, you know, the new 10-inch iPad will allegedly have Pencil support, iPad Pro class CPU, although probably not quite as high clocked, and smart connector for the only things that can use the smart connector are smart keyboards from Apple and Logitech.
And 4 gigs of RAM, please, 4 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, hopefully. We still don't know what the smart connector will be for on the 10-inch iPad. We can assume it will probably be for a smart keyboard, but part of the benefit of the smart keyboard, I'd say probably the biggest benefit of it, is that it functions as a regular iPad cover, a bigger, bulkier one, but still a regular iPad cover, so that makes it so that it has to actually remain the same size as the iPad for it to keep that benefit. So I'm assuming there would also be a second version of the Apple smart keyboard that would be smaller and would fit that size. And that makes sense. I mean, have you guys ever used an iPad keyboard cover for the 10-inch iPad from like Logitech and stuff?
Yep.
I don't think I have. No.
They're pretty good. I mean, like, you know, they're cramped, but they're usable.
They're not good to type on. They're good in that they, when you close them, they're the same size as your iPod. But as soon as you open it up, they're a terrible keyboard.
No, I would say they're okay. I mean, you know, for it, as much as you can make a usable keyboard that's only, you know, 9 inches or whatever wide, they're not bad. So it's possible to make one that's usable. However, it's not possible, in my opinion, to make one that's usable for the iPad mini. They've tried. Their companies have tried.
If you're an elf, you can use it.
The ones for the mini are really, really, I think that has crossed a threshold where it's just not possible to comfortably, you know, like touch type on something that size. I think obviously there is like a limitation here of like how small can you make a keyboard cover that is the same size as the device that it's covering and have it still be a usable physical keyboard.
I don't accept that limitation, though, which is why I brought it up for the 7 Plus. Because obviously in the 7 Plus, the smart connector on the hypothetical smart connector on the side, thought exercise, you wouldn't be for a keyboard that's the same size as the 7 Plus. You would have to break out of that and be more like the old Palm things where you have this little tiny screen, but say you're on a plane and you have stashed in your backpack a full-size keyboard with a smart connector.
Like an unfolds?
Yeah, and then you'd be like, oh, I have to do some serious emailing here. I don't want to thumb type it, even on my 7 Plus. Turn it sideways, smart connector, shove it into the little keyboard, put it on your tray table, blah, 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 and then the keyboard goes away. Like, the keyboard, you don't no longer have to tie the keyboard to the size of the device. Then that would let you sort of, you know, what would be your sort of on-your-road thing? I don't need to bring my MacBook One. All I got to bring is my iPhone 7 Plus and my folded-up smart connector keyboard slash stand for the 7 Plus if I need to do serious typing.
Well, you could also do that with a Bluetooth keyboard, though, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no, I know, but the smart connector is likely you don't have to have an extra battery that you have to do, and it could be thinner, it could be powered from the phone in the 7 Plus, which you're hoping has enough to power the, you know, the light demands of a keyboard, and it can be magnetic, and it can fold up and be the cloth thing, like, and you don't have to deal with Bluetooth, because in my experience, the tenuous connection between any device and its Bluetooth accessories is not a fun thing to have to manage.
I never have problems with my keyboard and mouse, but, I mean, to each their own.
It's not the keyboard and mouse that it, like, you have right in front of your computer. It's like my experiences are all WWC because it's the only time I ever do use any Bluetooth accessories. Constantly my iPad losing the Bluetooth connection to the keyboard and my iPad losing the tethering connection to my phone.
The other problem with a smart keyboard also is that the smart keyboard, at least as we know it so far, the smart connected devices are powered by the host iOS device. In theory, this smart connector on an iPhone would have to use the iPhone's battery to power the keyboard. Now, keyboards, you know, any kind of like wireless or, you know, otherwise keyboard, they use very little power. You know, they really don't take much. But do you really want something else draining power from the phone? Like another thing draining power from the phone?
I'm just assuming the keyboard is the power demands are so incredibly light. Like that you wouldn't even care. That it would be like it would be less power than turning Bluetooth on.
It might be. I don't know. But, you know, it's yet one more thing to consider. So basically, you know, we know Apple will say no to a lot of things that they just think would be clunky or would not have enough sat or whatever. I don't see them doing this. I just don't see them thinking that enough people want to use external keyboards on their iPhones that it would be worth making this. I mean, does anybody?
Well, the phone was just a mental exercise, but the more concrete one is the 9.7 inch iPad, which we all think going to have a smart connector. And now I'm saying, what if you had a 9.7 inch iPad? Do you have to have a keyboard that is the size of the 9.7, or can you actually use a larger full size keyboard with that? Why would you not want to use it? Like, does it have to be a keyboard slash also the thing that covers up my iPad? Why can't those be two distinct things, or why can't you have one without the other? Because at that size, I think it starts to make more sense. The phone is the more extreme example, and because, you know, I'm thinking of these phones getting bigger and more powerful and you graduating up to them, moving your way up to the iPad. So the phone is just to sort of ring out whether this is a product that might be useful. But we, you know, not that we know, but we're pretty sure there's going to be a smart connector there. And I've used those small keyboards and I don't think they're great. And once you have the smart connector on that one, I feel like, you know, if I was, again, trying to assemble a WWDC bag and I wasn't allowed to use an Apple laptop for some reason, I would choose a smart connector keyboard and a 9.7-inch iPad Pro over a Bluetooth keyboard and that same thing.
Oh, I would too, certainly. But, you know, we'll see what options we end up having. But, you know, I suspect that, you know, if they do this, you know, if there is new iPad, And if it has a smart connector, and if they release an appropriately sized version of the smart keyboard to plug into it, it's probably going to be decent. You know, it's probably not going to be like an amazing keyboard. I mean, the current smart keyboard isn't an amazing keyboard. It's okay. You know, most people who use it say it's roughly similar, if not slightly better, than the MacBook One keyboard. And yeah, if I was like, the reason I have tried iPad keyboard case covers before is because that combo of having an iPad on a keyboard cover is really nice on airplane tray tables. It is awesome for that because it fits on any of them. And if you don't already have a tiny laptop, that can be your airplane laptop. You know, not for doing tons of stuff if you're not usually accustomed to an iPad workflow, but it can be pretty cool for a flight, you know. So if they do this in a good way for the 10-inch iPad, that's great. They're going to sell a good number of them probably. I hope it'll be good. Again, I probably won't have any reason to ever buy one myself, but that's going to be really nice. So, you know, good on them. So I think if you look at this event we haven't talked about watch bands yet. Got to talk about watch bands. That's the last thing in the event, right?
You're not even wearing your Apple Watch anymore. What do you care, Mr. Mechanical Watch?
It's over there on top of my thing on my desk.
Mm-hmm.
Next to Tiff's, who's also not wearing hers anymore.
Well, not all of us are too cool for them. And so I'm curious to see what the bands are that they have in this particular event. But I don't feel like I'm in the market for one. I am fine with my sport band. I only have the one band for the Apple Watch. And I don't yearn for another, but, you know, I'm curious to see what they come up with.
Yeah, I mean, the rumors are that, you know, it's almost a given there that if they're going to make new bands at all, they're almost certainly going to have new colors of the sport band, because that's easy, right? You know, that doesn't take like a major, you know, rethinking of everything. And that's easy to change out with seasonal and annual fashion changes. So they're probably going to do that. But also a very strong rumor that I've heard a number of times is that they might do a NATO style strap, which I think would be a smart move because those are very much in fashion right now.
Wait, what does that mean?
I don't know what that is. No, no one knows what that is, but you, Margo.
I don't personally care for them, so I'll probably explain them poorly.
NATO?
Yeah. Yeah, like the organization. It's
American Treaty Organization. No, North Atlantic? What the hell is it? Oh no. It's North Atlantic, I think.
I don't know. But they're like a fabric, like a woven fabric. I think they often have a stripe. You know, it's like I'm probably destroying this for people who love these things because I don't really care for them, so I don't know much about them, but I know they're very much in fashion. So yeah, if you go search for NATO strap, you'll see what I'm talking about. You can see if you do this image search, you see they always have this weird kind of double loop attachment mechanism. They're kind of bulky, but because they're a woven nylon mesh usually, they're usually very comfortable. Just a little bit large for my taste, but people like them a lot. They're very much in fashion.
Watch fashion is like, I would like a miniature version of the Manhattan skyline on my wrist because that shows that I'm a city person and I love Manhattan. Okay. Like this NATO strap. Like, it's not, it looks like it is meant to evoke, it seems like, the type of straps used to attach equipment for people in the military and those type of sort of rugged outdoor mountaineering type stuff. But it isn't one. It is not attaching something that needs to be, like, all those loops are there. You know, it's like an art installation that is on your wrist. Like, you know, it is an imitation of another thing. And you're confused by the fact, well, it is a strap, right? It does actually hold it to my wrist. Yeah, it does hold it to your wrist. But all that crap on there is from another strap that does a job, not the job that this thing is doing. And I just, I can't imagine. I can't imagine adding additional metal things to a strap that's going to be around my wrist that are non-functional. Like, no, I don't, like, that's why the plasticky fluorelastomer, the sport straps appeal to me, because for the most part, they'd say, well, it's just a thing that goes on your wrist, and let's make it as squishy and as comfortable as possible. They kind of go weird with the clasping mechanism. But anyway, suffice it to say, I'm obviously not in the market for a new strap. Although what I would buy for $30 from Apple is a slightly smaller version of the little leather band that holds the, you know, that on the classic buckle or whatever the leather strap is that I have, that holds the little tongue, you know, the excess tongue that sticks out. That little band that's supposed to hold it needs to be slightly smaller because the little tongue slips out too easily.
That happens with every leather watch band I've ever used.
But you just got to make it a little bit smaller. Not a lot smaller, just a little bit.
Well, or they could just put in a deployant or something, but that's too fancy. They probably won't do that.
No one knows what that is but you.
It's...
you're
what
like,
did
this
you
is your
just
version
say?
Of, this is your version of Destiny. It's just a bunch of weird words that seem like they mean nothing, but they're...
Yeah, I agree. Thank God that John actually understands the pain we go through when he gets riffing on Destiny stuff.
Yeah, but so, Destiny is real. Watch bands are just made up stuff.
Right. So what did you call it? A deployment?
A deployant.
Oh, that makes even more sense.
It's a type of clasp. So normally you have like the little, you know, you loop the thing through the buckle and you loop it up and down, you know, so it kind of tightens that way. A deployant is something where like you kind of attach it to one of the holes and then you can open and close it with this metal opening and closing clasp mechanism. So you kind of fix the size to where you want it and then it's always at that size, I mean, until you readjust it. And it holds it flatter and it's quicker to put on and off. So it's considered a slightly better enclosure. Usually it's higher end, but you know, I mean, Apple could offer it for like $30 more. You know, Apple could do a good job with it if they wanted to, because Apple, honestly, Apple's bands are awesome. Like the quality of Apple's bands, the construction of them, the looks of them, the practicality and the comfort of Apple's bands is just worlds beyond most, not all, but most of what you can find in the fancy watch world. Apple's bands are great. And you know, they should really be commended on that. Like they for that being like their very first time they ever tried making a watch, and they make these amazing bands with this awesome, you know, quick detach swap mechanism. Like the rest of the watch world has nothing on that. Like they're so good. But there are things that they could borrow from the watch world to make a few slightly nicer ones, and one of those would be a decent leather with a deployant. But you know, I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Man, you really went.
I know. The advantage, John, if you... the reason I brought this up is that deployants usually don't have that problem with the leather bands with the ends slipping out, because it's kind of... The way it's held, it's kind of held in a more fixed way. It doesn't usually happen that way. I don't actually own any of these, but...
Yeah, I doubt I would buy one at the prices they are. Like, I haven't even been able to bring myself to buy a sport one just because it feels like it's not worth $50 for a piece of plastic or whatever they charge. And honestly, the leather strap is fine. The one annoyance is that the thing slips out.
I just can't believe how deep into the dark side, into the deep end or whatever, you went on this watch stuff.
Hey, you know how I do things.
I knew it was bad, but woof.
That's right up his alley.
Yeah, but wow. This is, I feel like we need an intervention at this point.
No, he's fine. everyone needs a hobby. This is a pretty benign hobby as far as hobbies. He's into jewelry, essentially, or jewelry, as people say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's jewelry. I like it. Thanks a lot for our three sponsors this week: Backblaze, MailRoute, and DevMate. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Accidental. Oh, it was accidental. Accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC. USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
John, what the hell happened to your iPod Touch?
It's stolen out of my car. People have broken into our cars while they sat in our driveways many times over the years that we've lived here. Apparently, this is a thing that people do. They just wander through the neighborhood.
Wait, at your house?
Yeah, they just wander through the neighborhood at night while everyone is asleep and check for open cars. And when they find one, they take any valuable stuff out of it.
Why would you not lock your car?
I always lock my car. I obsessively lock my car. I lock my car when I go into the elementary school to pick up my daughter for the 3 seconds it's out there. Always. Why was the car apparently unlocked? It could be the UI on the key fob, where it used to be three separate buttons, one of which was locked that was a different size than the other ones and was centrally located. And now that we talked about this when I got my new Accord, it is just like sort of like a single rectangular region divided in thirds, and the bottom one is lock. that it's not as bad as I thought it was when I first talked about my card key fob. I'm pretty good at finding the buttons, but it's conceivable that I could mash the wrong one absentmindedly. It's also conceivable that someone else in the house could grab some set of keys the wrong way and accidentally unlock the car because the signal can reach, you know, from inside of the house. Anyway, I probably just forgot. The scary thing about it is because I am so obsessive about locking my car, it basically means that every single night someone is checking all the cars, right? Because you know, what are the odds that the one day I forget to lock it is the one day it gets stolen? Because like literally, I'm really good about lock. I lock the house, I lock the car, I lock everything. I'm from New York. It's like what I do, right? So it has to be like the one time I slipped up in some way. And the other option is that they could be breaking in. And that's the past things. My wife never locks her car. So she's had her car broken into a million times. They took all the quarters out of the things. They probably go in there all the time and be like, oh, still nothing good in this car. But she used to have a lot of change in there for parking meters, and that all got taken out a couple of years ago. And then one time we came out and found, like, in the winter, the window rolled down on my car, or on a car that I had driven last. And anyone who's ever driven me knows I do not roll down the windows. Like, I don't like window cars. So I would never roll down. In the winter, and I'm always cold, forget it, right? So I didn't roll down the window on purpose. Don't think I did it accidentally. Maybe in the course of trying to break into the car, they somehow triggered the window rolling down. I have no freaking idea. But anyway, this is over the course of many years. And this time they went in and they took I think it was like second generation iPod Touch. It was some really old iPod Touch that was useless. Like you couldn't even give it to a kid. The whole point of it is like, great, this is what you do with old iPod Touches. You fill it up with music and you stick it in your car. It's your permanent, you know, music collection in the car. And yeah, I use Bluetooth on my phone for the car to listen to podcasts, but every once in a while I switch to the iPod source. You get like the display of the songs and everything. It's just nice to have a separate bucket for music and playlists and stuff like that. So they took that. They took the case that it was in, which was this little cute cloth case with a, you know, something from Etsy, I think. They took the wire. They did not take the Garmin GPS. the ancient dedicated Garmin GPS from the pre-iPhone days. They couldn't even be bothered. Even they recognized this is a worthless piece of technology. Nice. Yeah, so that was pretty annoying. So I've done is pulled yet another iPod. I did go through the exercise of find my iPhone, and of course it's not online anymore. And I set the thing to, you know, auto lock if it ever connects to the internet, because of course it didn't have lock on it. I don't think there was anything on it, because I think I had erased everything off of it except for just a music collection that this iPod Touch was too old to even use iCloud stuff. So I had synced with iTunes my music onto it. So I think all they've got is my collection of mostly DRM free music. If they ever do connect it to the internet, it will automatically lock itself. And yeah, it's just kind of depressing, kind of sad. And I'll just, you know, I guess I have to, I was thinking getting, look, if they're coming every night, I should get one of those little cameras that I hear advertised in other podcasts and just point it at my car and just see them on their nightly visit. Because really, it's amazing to me that, like, if I forgot to lock my car one night and that's the night it gets broken into, because I'm really very, very sure that I lock the car all the time. It is a thing I do obsessively.
I mean, for whatever it's worth, like, I mean, first of all, that sucks. Second of all, regarding the, like, you know, having some kind of camera thing. So we got a couple of like minor vandalism incidents at our house over the last couple of years, and fortunately they weren't major, but they were vandalism, and it really angered me. And you know, the second time it happened, or the most recent time it happened, I actually reported it to the local police, because I'm like, this is stupid. They should at least know about this. And I didn't think they'd actually do anything, and they couldn't. But I asked the officer who came by, because you know, it was the middle of the day, he had nothing to do with the suburbs. And I asked him, I'm like, you know, is there any value in me like putting up cameras? Like if I had the cameras and I had video of whatever like teenager was doing this, could you actually do anything with that, or is it just a waste of time? And he talked to me for, you know, a good 10 minutes. He you know, basically said, like, yeah, there's not much they can do. It's like, even if you know exactly which kid in town did it, which is, you know, not a given, but even if they knew exactly who did it, like, you know, most of the kids who do this kind of stuff are minors. And, you know, it's like, there's not that much they can do in that case. You might get your stuff back, or if the kid, you know, vandalizes your house, like, you might be able to try to get them to pay for it to be removed or cleaned up or whatever, but it's not like there's not much you can do. And I was thinking, like, once you go down like the security camera route, you kind of have to become like one of those like paranoid security people.
You have to go all the way you get into anything. I wouldn't have to. The only reason I would do it is, well, first of all, as for reporting it, I'm considering doing that too. Not because I expect anything to happen, just because I want to affect the crime statistics of my neighborhood to let people know that, hey, this is a thing. I want to be a number on a spreadsheet somewhere at the end of the year when they tally up, you know, silly petty theft in my town, right? And then the camera would just be, just because I'm curious. Like, basically, it's the divide. Is it kids or is it adults? Right? Because if it's kids, is it the same group of kids that's been doing it over the course of 5 years that it spans the time, or maybe it's even more than that? Like, can't be the same kids because they would have aged out of it. Or is it things passed on from kid to kid? Like, kids just know when you reach a certain age, they learn from their older siblings that you go down the neighborhood at 3 a.m. and check every single car to see if it's open because there might be valuable stuff in there. Or is it adults? I don't know. So anyway, I would just be doing it to satisfy my curiosity. And if it was kid, what I would do with that information is tell their parents. I'd find them, bring this. If I knew, oh, I know that kid, he's down the block, I would bring the video to the parents and said, your son in the night is stealing crap out of my car. And by the way, give me my iPad back, or my iPod back.
Yeah, that's worth $50.
Yeah, well, it's worth less than that, but it's the principle. You know, kids, you can get in trouble with their parents. And, you know, I'm hoping that they have parents who would care about this or whatever. Gonna be ever vigilant. And honestly, seriously, I'm fascinated by the idea that at such an incredibly frequent interval, people are just trying every single car, in the whole neighborhood. Because they're not just trying my one house, right? They've got to be going...
Well, I mean, chances are, I think you probably just got unlucky that they probably aren't going through that frequently. I'm guessing this just happened to be the day that you unlocked the car. It's possible this could be going on every night, but I think it's unlikely.
Well, when I talked about it on Slack, other people from, someone from Seattle and some people from the West Coast were saying this is a thing, that people go through neighborhoods and check for open car doors. Like, it is a common, low-level, easy way to get free stuff without actually committing a real crime. You're not actually breaking anything. You're not actually, it seems like
I think that is still theft.
You know what I mean, but it's not like you're breaking the window with a rock and then stealing the radios out of the car, or some people have their transmission gouged out of their car in an attempt to hotwire it or whatever. And even my brother, when he lived in the more downtown areas, had his car broken into a few times where they would actually break things on the car. So I'm thankful that this is the most polite thieves ever. Oh, the car's locked, move on. They're like stormtroopers in A New Hope. Door's locked, move on to the next one. Not really good at trying to find things, because obviously you would just lock the door if you were hiding there. I don't want them. If they broke my window, I would be super pissed, right? If they just gently opened the door. They didn't close, they left all the bins open so I could tell what they had rummaged through, so they didn't even clean up after themselves. But I don't know. I'm mostly just curious, morbidly curious, who is doing this? I mean, it would make me feel better if it was kids, but on the other hand, I would be like, all right, kid, you need to get in trouble.
Yeah, but the reality is, the kind of kid who would go around doing that, chances are, even if you told their parents, the chances that their parents would, A, believe you, even if you show them a video, B, care, and C, not just get pissed at you, I think are pretty low.
No, I think they're pretty high in the neighborhood I'm in, because it doesn't mean that the kids who are doing this have to do it to get money or anything. It's just a prank, a fun thing to do. I don't think these kids need, and really seriously, if they knew anything about it, they should have looked at this iPod and thrown it back, just like they didn't take the garment. It's a piece of crap. It's useless, right? Seriously, they're going to, and I think I had upgraded it to the latest supported OS, so it was incredibly slow. You're not going to be happy with that thing you just stole. Trust me. You're going to find it back on the hood of my car eventually. Sorry, this is useless. You can have it back. Keep it with your Garmin.
You should have a honeypot, something like, maybe have it look just like an iPod Touch, but it's actually an Android, Nexus 4 or whatever, and it's loaded with all sorts of garbage. Or you know what? I got it. Make it the real iPod Touch, but have it only contain the U2 album.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I could just take, I put one of your Kindles each day in there as there little bait, each day, and see if I think they'll leave the Kindle too, is they'd be like, this isn't an iPad. Look at this, the screen isn't even color. I can't even touch it. Forget it.